If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
I got stuff for you.
Holy moly.
I need to get some snakes and release them around my house.
But I love eating people. I love eating kids.
These guys are the scientists of the supernatural, lecturers leaving lessons for inquiring laymen. They are applying the scientific method to a world that baffles science. They are the cryptids of the corn.
Every day that you open your mouth,
I know, right?
I'm more convinced that you're abducted by aliens.
No.
And it just stood up. I mean, it just like kept going and going. And she goes, what the?
These are idiots.
I was laughing reading this because I already knew how you would feel.
Idiot. What part of the story fits your balloon?
Well,
this isn't a UFO. Yeah.
But who else has big black wings and red eyes?
Batman.
Well, Mothman.
Oh, yeah, Mothman.
Well, everyone, I think we know exactly what it is. So say it all with me. It was the Sandhill Crane.
Would you try it?
No.
You wouldn't eat it?
No.
Why?
Because they're probably toxic.
There'd be a lot of poop in my pants. Seeing a 6-foot alligator go swinging through the air and slam into a tree.
Hello, 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 welcome back to Crimson Cool Podcast. I'm the great Mr. E.
And I'm Jay Clone 072. And they don't think it be like it is, but it do. It do. Believe it. Or not.
What is that from? Like, is that a, is that, were you?
Huh?
I don't know. What was that from? Was
that? They don't think it be like it is, but it do?
Yeah.
It was a quote from a baseball player from like the 70s. And that was on the back of his card, was his quote. Sometimes they don't think it be like it is, but it do.
But it do.
Yep. Scooby Dooby Doo.
Where are you? We got some work to do now.
One time I said that to a kid when I was coaching track in junior high. They said something about, but it do. And I said, Scooby Dooby Doo. And she turned around real quick and looked at me and said, how about Scooby Dooby don't? That's what she told me. And I was like, oh, all right. I thought it was pretty good. She got me. Bella was her name. Never recovered from it.
Never recovered from it. You actually died that day.
A hair fell out of my head.
The only hair you had.
I have like Homer Simpson hair. Oh, man. Is this just Wednesday where we're going to free talk a little bit?
No.
Oh, okay. Is that for Mondays?
We probably could do that for Monday. I'm recording this back. We always record the weeks kind of like backwards or reverse. Monday's episode is normally like one of the last things we record.
We kind of like jump around, don't we?
Yeah.
It's always Friday first.
Yeah. Oh, I guess for us, it's a warm up. Like,
because if
it's
you guys
easy to talk about science and animals,
and if you're not listening to, if you're listening to this show and you're not listening to Freaky Fauna Friday, you're missing out. You're just missing. I'm telling you, it's a whole lot of science and nature and animals you're missing out on.
That's funny you said that because that's what this episode is, pretty much just a big Freaky Fauna Friday.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
All right, here's a Freaky Fauna preview.
This is like
extended.
This may be a Wednesday mini series. Because I found an article that I expanded upon about giant mysterious fish of Japan.
Oh, hey.
That feels vaguely racist.
That's what they sound like. That's what they say. Hey. It means like it's like them acknowledging like how would that translate to English? It's almost like okay or or you're just acknowledging, like, something. Hey.
Okay.
I don't know. Sumo wrestling's going on right now, so maybe they're going to... Oh, is this the fish the Ozeki hold up when they become Ozeki?
What fish do they hold up?
I don't know. Whenever they reach the rank of Ozeki, I guess.
Pull up a picture of that while I read.
And sumo wrestling, they have this big ceremony where they reach the rank. You know, it's a pretty big deal. And then, but they're always holding this big fish. They give him a big fish to hold up, and they always pose with pictures of it.
Probably a black carp or a big head carp, something like that. No, it's the first one we're going to talk about is the Namit Aro.
Namit Aro.
Yep.
Okay.
The Namit Aro in Takamani Pond. They always have these prefectures, which I guess are they kind of like counties in Japan?
Yeah, I would say they're like counties
because they're bigger than like local. But they're not like massive.
Yeah, right? It's not like towns or regions. It's just like it's like areas. Yeah, prefectures are like that. Best way, yeah, is like counties here.
The Niigata prefecture.
Okay.
The Namit Aro. Japan lies a 540 meter above sea level, which is right around 1,700 feet in the wilderness area. It is known for its pristine wilderness, camping, and hiking availability. Is also allegedly home to an enormous fish locals affectionately refer to as the Namit Aro.
Okay.
The fish is said to be between 2 and 4 meters long, aka 6 to 13 feet in length, and covered in extremely large scales.
Mm.
The Namit Aro rarely comes to the surface, but is known to startle people strolling along the pond from time to time. Because they kind of scare it, so it does a big splash as it turns away and stuff and scares the bejesus out of people.
Like those manateees?
Yeah.
Kayakers running
They're kind of sleeping or whatever, and they get bumped, and then they freak out.
Yeah.
But they're just massive, and you just didn't know they were there. And this only happened... Oh, sorry. Where was I? Fishermen have also claimed on occasion to have hooked the beast, only to have it break their lines.
Hmm.
One report of a close encounter described how a man had entered waist-high water in the pond to retrieve something he had dropped in. As he blindly felt through the murky water in the silty bottom, his hand came up against what he mistook as a large log on the bottom. It was only when the log suddenly began to slowly swim away that he realized it was an incredibly large and powerful fish.
Wasn't a log.
The mysterious fish was so large and powerful that it swept its tail as it swam and actually bumped into the man, knocking him down into the water. The man described as being terrified and quickly exited the water to see an extremely large wake as whatever he had touched had totally sank back into the depths.
Okay.
I've told you the story where I kicked that alligator thinking it was a log.
Yeah, you and Nick, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure I've shared that story, but it makes you think of that. You're just like, yeah, it's a big log.
Bump.
It's an alligator.
And then it swims away.
You may think a pond is an odd place for such a large cryptid, as small and shallow as ponds normally are, and this one is no exception, being only 13 meters at its deepest. How deep is 13 meters?
Oh, gosh. What's that, 39?
About 40 feet.
40 yeah. feet.
So, yeah, 39 would probably change. In addition, the area is quite popular for hiking and camping. There are many campgrounds, parks, shops, and fishing and restaurants in the vicinity of the pond. And you can find pictures of it. There are actually some really cool like sculptures in the area of the fish.
Okay.
So it's just kind of weird that there's such a big animal in such a little pond.
Or is it? Sinkhole Sam.
The Sinkhole Sam. I mean, it was not a pond. He was in a lake.
Was it a lake?
Yeah, it wasn't big. It wasn't massive, but it was.
Lake, pond, you know.
There's a huge difference.
Indian Lake's a big pond.
What do you mean? Structurally, it's technically a reservoir. It's not either.
But. Oh, really? I guess you're right.
Oh, I am right. You're going to argue with me about water definitions?
Well, no, I'm just saying. Yeah, it's a big pond. It's a big mud puddle.
Indian Lake, the original lake is a glacial lake, which is around like the bridge and everything where you can actually find rock bottom.
Yeah.
The rest of it, and now that part of it classifies as a reservoir because they built the dam up to raise the whole thing.
Okay, that makes sense.
So it is not a pond or a lake.
And I looked up that fish that the sumo wrestlers hold. It's a Thai or a Japanese sea bream.
Yeah.
I don't know what that is.
Show me a picture.
It's just a big.
Just like really just snappers and stuff like that.
It represents good fortune.
But yeah, so it's a very, very populated area. The Namatoro has become somewhat of a local legend in the area. And most people who pass through pause at the pond hoping to see the fish. Or its large wakes that it's said to leave as it produces its cruising underneath the surface. These waves are so well known that it indeed has a name. The Namatoro is a combination of the Japanese word wave, nami, toro, Japanese was your first name, sort of like John for us in America.
Mm.
So it's like Wave John is kind of like the shorthand name for him.
Gotcha.
So he's named after his wakes.
Okay.
It's so common. It has been speculated that the Namit. Okay, before I get on, there are several fish that this could be. So do you remember how big I said it's commonly seen?
Oh gosh. Like log size, what'd
you
say?
6.5 to 13 feet.
Okay, that's pretty big.
I mean, it is, but for a freshwater fish, that's not astronomical. There's plenty of species that get to especially the 6.5 foot mark, and there's a handful of purely freshwater species that get to the 13 foot mark.
Well, like alligator gar?
Alligator gar, aeropyma, I mean, from around the
sturgeon.
World. Sturgeon. I mean, sturgeon get way bigger than that, depending on the species of sturgeon. There are
white sturgeon.
Yeah, which are androgynous.
Oh, yeah. Ocean and freshwater.
Yeah. Where they spend their adult life in the ocean. But there's even some salmonids that used to get that big. But yeah. What do you think? Or do you have any ideas what it could be? You know a lot about Japan.
Yeah. Oh, I know what it could be. It could be a kappa. They don't even mention kappas yet. It could be that. It's the best cryptid. If anyone doesn't know, that's the best cryptid ever. The kappa. Listen to our episode on it, and then just the lore behind the kappa. It's just so good. And if you're in our Patreon, you already know.
Kappa sucks.
I just fought one in D&D, or not D&D, sorry, RPG, right? We're not allowed to say D&D, are we?
No, you can't. It's D&D styled. It's not D&D official or anything like that.
It stands for...
I mean, you can say Dungeons & Dragons. We're not like copying it.
Okay.
Because you can buy like... Pathfinder guides and stuff like that to use for your own campaigns. I mean, that's like, there's plenty of big podcasts that like that's what they do.
Oh, okay.
So like Pathfinder is like a rule set for D&D and stuff like that. It's much simpler than D&D.
Kind of like how we play it, I'm guessing. But yeah, just wrestled with Kappa there. So join our Patreon and get in our Discord and listen to them D&D episodes where I'm pretty sure I won. If I remember correctly, I rocked that thing.
I don't think so.
I think I did.
But you think it's a kappa?
We're in Japan, water. I mean, it could be. But if I'm going like biology, actual fish, I mean, I don't know. I mean, what is the Wells catfish saying over there? It's a little.
No, but Wells get that long.
Right. Yeah. That's a big one. Mm-hmm. Ooh. Giant Japanese salamander. It's always
he comes up on this list.
Yeah, he's always a culprit of what could be.
So we can talk about that one first. So that is one suggestion that it's not actually a giant fish. It's a giant Japanese salamander. as far as I know, they have not been found in the pond, as in surveyed properly. I tried to look. Their range is pretty fragmented. So their direct range is a bit fragmented, so it can be a little hard to actually pinpoint where they are. But yeah, I mean, they get 6 foot long, a couple hundred pounds. They're very secretive. They're not on the surface very often, but if they're mm-hmm. in shallow waters, which they prefer, and you startle them, you could see a big wake and a splash. Mm-hmm. So that is a pretty good culprit.
Couldn't they just do an eDNA survey and just get a sample of water?
They could. As far as I know, there's never been one done.
What are they thinking? Don't they know how to discover everything through eDNA?
You could.
Everything that ever existed, we know.
You would.
It's in there. Kind of.
If it has any organic remains, yes.
Well, and if it's in your data bank already.
Yeah.
So that's the part I was hinting at. That's probably not in there.
A giant Japanese salamander would probably be in a Japanese...
Salamander would be, but whatever this fish is.
Oh, I thought...
If it's a mystery.
Yeah. Another one could be a type of large Asian carp. There's several culprits that kind of fall under this category.
Mm-hmm.
Grass carp and black carp are, you know, somewhat endemic in most pond environments. You can buy them to stock into your ponds and such. These species of carp can, you know, vary in sizes, but can get pretty big. Black carp, for instance, can reach, in some instances, 6 feet and weigh over 200 pounds. And then there's a rare, even gianter species of carp called the Siamese giant carp. It is one of the world's top 7 largest fish.
Wow.
They used to get to the size of a VW bug.
Okay.
They're extremely rare, and some scientists argue that they're actually functionally extinct. Last one we have, and a big, big adult. Like, you can actually find them in some, like, paid fishing ponds and stuff like that. Uh-huh. It's kind of where they're saved.
Yeah.
Because they were, you know, caught from the wild, brought into there as babies and stuff like that. But like, Jeremy Wade went to a couple of those where, you know, to find something, like, in Thailand, he went to one and was catching an alligator gar.
Those ponds are insane over there.
So that's where some of these guys are. So there's a thought that it's one of these, which they, for their size, they can be very, very secretive.
Okay.
And
kind of like giant catfish.
Yeah.
They can be pretty secretive too, even though they can get as big as VW, whatever, bugs as well.
Yeah. So there's a chance that this fish is actually one or several giant Siamese carp that may have been brought up there within the last century.
Hmm.
And because they live a long time and they grow really slow. And they're just kind of hanging out.
And there's never been reports of this thing ever attacking anybody, right?
No. It's more like a local, like, pet.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not, like, friendly where people are feeding it, like extreme, Sam. Like Sam.
Yeah, but...
But it more or less just scares people because they don't know it's there.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't, like, hit you. Like, the one guy was literally, like, touching it when it knocked him over.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't turn around and try to eat him or nothing like that. It was leaving.
Yeah, he was just there.
He was touching it, and it left.
Yeah.
It just was big. And when I've been in the water with, like, white surgeon and stuff like that, doing blood collection,
mm-hmm.
they can do that on accident. They don't. There's no nefarious.
They're just big.
Deeds. They're just big.
Yeah.
It's just, they're big, and they don't want to be contained.
Like a big dog that leans on you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he just wants to touch you or feel your presence, but he's so big, he shoves you over.
So a lot of the people that have caught or said they've hooked this fish were actually fishing for carp when that happened.
Okay.
Doesn't necessarily mean anything, but they were using carp catching tactics.
And it just happened to snag one.
Mm-hmm. And then it broke off the line. There's also a chance it's an Amur sturgeon. You already mentioned a sturgeon. An Amur sturgeon, Amur, A-M-U-R, Amur. I've never said it right.
A-M-U-R?
Yeah. It's an Asian word for, like, there's, like, Amur tigers, there's Amur sturgeon, like...
Amur. Mm-hmm. Amur.
But they are critically endangered. Critically endangered. Their population is highly fragmentary, but they're massive fish, getting up to 3 meters in length.
Huh. Well, that fits the bill.
With large serrated scales.
Ooh.
They don't really frequent the top. They are a freshwater species of fish in the sturgeon family, being able to grow up to 3 meters and weigh about 200 kilograms. This species can primarily be found in two distinct morphic populations. One is gray and one is brown in the Amur River and the Amur estuaries. The sturgeon is potoambius migratory, which is just the same thing as androgynous.
Okay.
They spend some of their time out in the ocean and such. Due to overfishing and caviar production, this species has been listed as critically endangered. And their species has been highly fragmented to this.
When did we do that episode on caviar when we talked about...
We didn't. DW did it on Cruel Foods.
Oh, Cruel Foods. Oh, I just remember listening to it. That's right. Or I remember editing it. That's what I meant to say.
Because it is a cruel food.
It is.
It is horrible for such a long-lived animal to... Yeah, anyways, it doesn't matter for this part.
Go check out DW Conspiracy Shack.
Amur sturgeons are massive fish. Like I said, grow up to 3 meters and 200 kilograms. There are thought to be known hybrids between Amur sturgeon and the Kaluga sturgeon, which is known as the largest species of sturgeon in the world.
Okay.
So that's that one we talked about in Russia that they...
Yeah.
They used to take two boats to haul a big adult in. There's a chance they're one of the largest fish ever, like living today if they're still around.
If they're still, yeah.
There's an unsanctioned report of one being 27 feet and like 8,000 pounds.
It's a big fish.
Bigger than most white sharks.
Yeah, that's pretty big.
You're getting to levels of like whale sharks and basking sharks, like big benthic feeders or baleen feeders.
But good thing it's a sturgeon and not like a muskie or something.
Well... The Kaluga may have eaten people. Like, we are small enough compared to it.
Yeah.
That I think we would probably fall onto
be on its menu?
The food chain. You just got to run into them. It's just hard to run into them.
Aren't sturgeon, don't they have like those teeth in their throat?
They're called, I'm blanking on all my words today.
Biology. Come on, snap into it.
No, pharyngeal teeth.
Pharyngeal.
Basically big crushing pads.
Okay. Is that what would get you then? If this thing ate
you? Gosh, no. I mean, I wouldn't even imagine if you got crushed. That would be horrible.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's basically a two hydraulic press is made of teeth.
Okay. So it's not like they don't like sharp teeth on the outside or nothing.
No, so Kaluga's actually had more frontward facing mouths than a lot of sturgeon, and they were much more predatory than a lot of sturgeon. They weren't like extreme predators, but they were salmon eaters.
Okay. But they're not like just... cruising along the bottom, getting clams and whatnot and crab.
No,
right?
No, not like a lake sturgeon.
Okay.
But yeah, being the size of this fish, they had gigantic lateral scutes, which are these sharp bony plates that protrude through the skin. And like I said, they had two color morphs. They had these giant ossifications. They were mostly found. So do you know where the Sea of Japan is for Japan?
It's
in between Japan and China.
Okay.
And Korea and all that. So that body of water between
that
Japan.
Inland, yeah.
It's not inland. It's connected to the ocean still.
Like okay. So but it's between Japan and the mainland of whatever.
That, yeah. And then they would go into China, like right at the top of Japan is a lot of their historic ranges.
Oh, okay.
So they would go into Japan too, but the Amur River empties into the ocean right there near the top of Japan. So one thought is... that this may be some of the surviving Amur sturgeons are getting into some of these mountain ponds and lakes. And there's, they live to be 200.
Yeah.
So they just haven't gone back to the ocean yet, or they got stuck in there due to damming and stuff like that, and they turned around. So both Amur sturgeons and Kaluga sturgeons have been seen being blocked into and becoming basically lake run versions of themselves.
Landlocked.
Yeah. So there's a chance that it's a sturgeon. And that would fit a lot of the stuff. Harmless, benthically feeding, so feeding on the bottom.
Big
slow. They don't spend a lot of time on the surface whatsoever. They don't like to be on the surface. But when they get startled, they can jump. The Amur sturgeon did feed primarily on mollusk in their diet. That made 87% of their food.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So that's, bottom-dwelling stuff. But the fish they really preferred was pond smelt, which can be found all over China and Japan in little bodies of water all the way up into the mountains.
And then it turns out this pond is filled with them.
There are pond smelt into this pond, yes.
Okay.
They do enjoy pond smelt.
Hmm. Well, there we go. This guy might fit the bill here, too.
Yeah, it's not a perfect fit for me.
Yeah?
But there are enough, things there. And
overlap.
And the people there in Japan aren't talking like it's a... like... a monster, it's just a big fish.
Yeah.
And they have a name, like we said, it's basically, it roughly translates to like Wave John.
Okay.
So like Sinkhole Sam, like there's kind of like, well, he just is out there. Everybody tries to see him. Any questions about that one?
About the sturgeon?
The sturgeon and this fish and everything like that. So I'd say it's probably either a Siamese carp that was brought and put into the pond when it was a baby. It is now an adult, or, you know, a juvenile.
Yeah.
And, you know, weighing 200 pounds.
That's your take? That's what you think it was?
Or the Amur sturgeon. Because there's a lot of carp fishermen that basically describe it as a giant carp.
Okay. Shoot. Which
there is a giant carp.
You don't have some, like, crazy fish that none of us thought of? That fits the bill, like, perfectly.
You knew about a Volkswagen-sized carp?
I mean, no.
Right down the road?
No, I didn't, but
the soon-to-be-extinct Amur sturgeon that was...
I'm still waiting for something even crazier, though. It's like, well, these ones don't quite fit, but...
I would say it's either or. I mean, okay. I think it's probably one of these.
Okay.
And Japan has a long history of... I mean, they are a fish-obsessed country.
Yeah.
Good, bad, and different, doesn't matter. But even, like... introduced fish.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could date back thousands of years introducing fish from like mainland China. Even some European species were being brought over. They like fish a lot.
Oh yeah.
You know, it's a sign. So like one of the jobs I had a long time ago was working for a guy that bred native US fishes, and Japanese were a huge buyer because a big thing with like some business people in Japan was having the most extreme fish tanks in their offices.
Oh, okay.
Like, bowfin were very, very popular over there.
Yeah.
As an American, you know, apex predator.
Mm-hmm.
Because they'd put them in with, like, snake heads and stuff like that. And the bowfin aren't nearly as fast aggressive, but they don't lose fights.
Right.
So, yeah. They're very popular. So I can definitely see Siamese carp being brought in before they were pretty much extinct.
And then just worked its way into this pond. And
somebody literally throwing one in there.
Okay.
Like bought one in China or from somewhere and threw one in there.
And it just lived.
Mm-hmm. I mean, besides their size, they're not like, how do I say this? Like the requirements aren't crazy special.
Like a goldfish kind
of? I wouldn't say they're that extreme. Okay. Pollution is a big part of why they're being limited. They were hunted to extinction, or not to extinction, to near extinction in China. Dams were a huge problem for them, for their migratory patterns to breed. And then pollution kind of, you know, was a big nail in their coffin. So it's not like they're impervious.
Yeah, but it wasn't like the food chain is what got them.
Yeah.
Just being eaten by other animals or outcompeted. Yeah,
I mean, I 100%, you could throw these in a pond. They have them, they still, like the Siamese carp that are still around are in ponds.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, for fishing.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Well, carp are pretty hardy, too.
Generally speaking, as a group, they are. They are the Asian cyprinids, though. There are members that are very sensitive.
Okay. Oh, every group has those, I guess.
It's hard because the poster child you know of is very tough.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the average is probably the average cyprinid, the Asian cyprinids, which is Lucinidae, something like that, I think. So cyprinids is the minnows. Carps are minnows in the family, that family group. But they're the Asian cyprinids.
Mm-hmm.
The average is probably right down the middle of being sensitive.
Oh, okay.
So, but the ones you know of as poster children are very, very tough and resilient.
Yeah, because they get in everywhere and they're invasive and they take over.
Yeah. I mean, common carp are Asiatic and a European. But yeah. So I would say this guy, the Namit. Oh, now I got to pull back. The Namitaro is probably either a Siamese carp or maybe an Amur sturgeon. I'm going to lean more towards, for me personally, the Siamese carp. Now, a bunch of these are like little not one-offs, but there's just not a lot about them. They're just like, yeah, it's, you know, there's a giant fish that lives in my pond.
Yeah.
But yeah, any questions or thoughts about that?
No, that's pretty neat. And it's nice hearing little stories I'm going to call this thing a cryptid because we just don't know exactly what it is.
I mean, nobody knows what it is. Yeah. I mean, I have thoughts, but I didn't see it.
Right, exactly. So I like little stories like this. Harmless, just fun little local lore.
The giant trout of Hokkaido.
Oh, yeah. Or Hokkaido.
Hokkaido?
Yeah. Okay. H-O-K-K-A-I-D-O.
Yeah. Hokkaido?
Hokkaido, yeah.
Okay. If fishing is your game, you've heard of a Hokkaido's lake. Okay. Shikosuta? Yeah.
Okay.
It's a famous fishing lake there. There's a chance you can catch one of the mysterious denizens in its depths, the mysterious giant trout of the lake. The lake is a caldera lake.
Oh, meaning like it was an old volcano, right?
Yep, the top of a volcano. The average depth of 870 feet. and it's categorized as the eighth largest lake in Japan by surface area. This lake is well known for its extremely excellent fishing, being a world-known destination.
Wow, that's pretty neat.
Being home to the Japanese record brown trout, which are not native. That is a European fish. Hmm. But we have them here, okay, too, and they traveled the world.
Okay.
Being home to the record brown trout, which was 3 feet long and 30 pounds.
That's a nice trout.
That is a humongous brown trout. And there's a subspecies of brown trout we'll talk about in a second that it just gets massive. They call them the wolf or pharynx trout. The big, but perhaps the most famous attraction, are the mysterious gigantic trout said to inhabit the deepest parts of the lake. Fishermen have long reported what they describe as giant trout, estimated at well over, you know, locally saying 2 meters, which is 6.5 feet in length and out in depths in the deepest areas of the lake. One boat full of fishermen was astonished when they saw a whole school of these absolutely enormous fish near the surface, ranging from 1.5 to 3 meters in length.
Wow. A school of them.
4 to 9 feet.
That's wild. I'd love to see that. I mean, just throw your net out in there.
I mean, yeah, you would be dragged to your death.
Yeah, I know. Throw your net over it. Yeah.
When the fish were pulled near the boat, the fisherman and his cohorts were totally blown away by the sheer size of the catch. It was unlike anything they'd ever seen in years fishing in the lake. As the fishermen stared in disbelief, the gigantic fish broke the line and darted off deep into the depths. Although the lake is home to many salmonids, such as the brown trout, rainbow trout, red salmon, none of them account for the vast sizes described by the mysterious fish. Before I continue, do you have any thoughts on what this could be? So there's already, this lake is home to dozens of introduced species fishing.
Right.
From all around the world. There are U.S. species in here. There are, and I think one of the culprits may be a U.S. species. A lot of European species are introduced into here.
Okay.
And even some mainland Chinese species.
Well, I have a thought, and maybe you'd have the answer for it.
Okay.
Can two separate, like, you know, like a lion and a tiger, you know, hybrid vigor, is that possible in fish?
So there's actually a trout called a tiger trout that is that.
Okay. Did they get bigger than normal? Like, does that happen, I guess?
Yeah, so a tiger trout is a hybrid between a brown trout and a brook trout.
Mm-hmm.
So brook trout are incredibly small.
Okay.
Probably the smallest native salmonid we have here in the U.S. And brown trout are not very closely related. So almost all of their babies are always sterile.
Okay.
It's like mules and horses where they're just not... They're close enough to sometimes produce viable offspring, but... Or not viable offspring. To produce offspring that aren't viable.
Okay.
So they cannot... That's it. That's the end of it.
Kind of like saw guy?
Yeah. Where... Even though that's not true necessarily now.
Right, can produce viable.
So these guys can't. Like, they're done. Like, you
can tiger trout.
You can make them in a captive setting.
And it ends there.
And it ends there. They do not reproduce.
Okay.
So hybrid vigor can produce some very big fish, but when one of the parents
is very tiny,
yes, it's almost all manufactured.
Okay.
There's very few. So salmonids are very, very peculiar, or sorry, not peculiar, picky. Salmonids are the salmon and trout family for everybody at home. I just keep saying that word, but that's what it means. Salmonid just means salmon, trout, whitefish, and grayling are kind of the big overall group of that. Char as well. They are very, very particular about how and when they reproduce.
Right. Like the temperature of the water has to be at
a... salinity and substrate.
Oh, gosh. It's crazy.
So they're very, very picky. And then species commonly don't overlap. Even at events like salmon runs, where multiple species are reproducing on the exact same time in the exact same place, hybridization is almost unheard of in the wild.
Okay.
It just doesn't happen because even if those fry, they do produce hybrid fry, they're just not going to survive. They're going to get picked apart because they look different.
Oh, makes sense. Okay.
There's nobody to hang out with to help survive.
Yep. It looking different is a problem in nature.
It's hard, yeah. So that, especially when a salmonid's whole survival strategy as a baby is to blend in with the school.
Yeah, exactly.
And so if you're the one that looks off, the predator's going to pick you out. The northern pike is going to eat you.
Yep. Oh. Pesky fish.
What? Nothing.
Oh, no. Did you just tip your hat?
So there's many options this could be. A lot of people point to some monads. So the, actually, the world record somonid may be the big candidate for this.
Hmm.
Okay, it's a taimen. You ever heard of a taimen, a golden taimen? Jeremy caught one. Jeremy Wade.
Yeah.
He had to go out to the middle of Russia, and they're monsters.
Okay.
Specifically, the Sharkahullen taimen is the world's largest salmonid living to modern day. They can reach 2 meters, 6.5 feet long, and they can weigh 220 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And they look like, the best way to describe them, they look like if a bowfin and a trout had a baby.
That's pretty sweet.
They're just a big, like, bony head full of teeth and then a trout body.
Okay.
So taimen are incredibly aggressive predators. Taimen are not known to really inhabit lakes, though.
What are they, in rivers?
Yeah, they're pretty much river exclusives. But they punch way above their weight class. Jeremy Wade, when he was fly fishing for him, they were using like 1.5 feet long flies to catch these fish because they want to eat mammals.
Oh, okay.
They want to like catch a rat or a marmot, or, like swimming across the river and stuff like that, or a duck.
Yeah.
Or each other.
Gosh.
Like the one he caught had another one's tail hanging out of its mouth. Like they're monsters. They are true monsters. Which trout can be very, very aggressive, but most trout are very small.
Mm-hmm.
They're still just as mighty as, you know, fierce, but they're living in very small ecosystems.
Yeah.
So you're not dealing with a 6-foot-long taimen. So that's one people point out a lot, that there's a chance it's an introduced taimen population.
Mm-hmm.
To me, the depth is a real big hindrance to that. As far as I could find, taimen do not like lakes, let alone being in very deep lakes. They have extremely large eyes. They're sight predators. They feed exclusively near the surface and oftentimes off the surface.
Okay.
And they like rivers.
And these guys are catching them at the depths of the pond or lake.
Yeah. And oxygen's a big problem.
Mm.
So trout, salmonids specifically, some of them are very, very tolerant of low oxygen environments.
Mm.
But most trout are very, very particular about oxygen consumption. Like it's very hard to take brookies, for example. Brookies can be in lakes, they're commonly known as brookies. They can be found in lake environments mm-hmm. where other trout species aren't present, but they have to have high O2.
Okay.
High dissolved oxygen in the water. But yeah, so a lot of people point to this taimen because it's the right size. It's 6.5 feet long and they weigh 220 pounds.
Hmm. It's the bill there.
Yeah. But like I said, taimen are not known to inhabit lakes. They are found in Hokkaido, though, in some areas they've been introduced. There's a population that somehow got into the lake. Maybe that's what this giant mysterious trout could be. The giant trout are seen in the depths of the water in the lake and almost never near shore.
Okay.
Which is another thing that points against the taimen for me.
Yeah.
The people that encounter them are almost always in the middle of the lake in the deepest part. So sightings are extremely rare. It is suggested that launching expedition to search for the giant trout. So hopefully we'll get some answers here soon. There's several groups that really want to find out what the species is. I have thoughts.
What do you think it is?
Well, you know all of my culprits.
Okay.
I think it is a North American fish.
Okay, well, I heard you.
Well, two of the fish that it could be are Northern Hemispherian fish.
Okay.
One of them is a North American, Northern Hemispherian fish too. They're all three Northern Hemispherian. Lake trout.
Okay, just lake trout.
Massive. They can get humongous. They are known as deep water dinosaurs.
Okay.
They grow really slow. They love depth. I mean, we've personally fished for them in 400 something feet of water. But they've been down, depending on oxygen layers and stuff like that, they've been down to like 600, 700, 800, 900 feet. So this lake is perfect for them. They do not like being close to other salmonids.
Okay.
So like where you're fishing for king trout normally, or king salmon in Lake Michigan, if your lure drops too low, that's when you start catching lake trout.
Okay.
Because they won't be necessarily schooled up with the kings, but they'll be below. The average lake trout is not very big. You know, I'm going to say the average for like here in the U.S. is 5 pounds. Historically, they can get 60 to 80 pounds and be almost 5 feet long. And in Russia, in some parts of northern Canada, there are historic records of them getting 6.5 feet and being well over the 100-pound mark.
Okay.
They live a long time. They grow really slow. Then they love eating other salmonids. And what they do is kind of sit and wait at the deep depths and they shoot up to grab other salmonids.
Oh.
And a lot of what these guys witnessed, that's kind of what they witness. A lot of people saying the giant trout they're seen when they're pulling in other fish.
Okay. So it's chasing them up.
Yeah. And that's actually how you, for ice fishing here in the United States, how you fish for lake trout. is you basically drop your big lure to the bottom and you reel as fast as you can.
And chase it.
Because they want the chase. They don't. Yeah. Yeah. So I really think there's a good chance it's a lake trout that was introduced and they probably thought they didn't take. And then, you know, 3 or 4 decades later,
here they are.
They start seeing them and they get huge and they're slow growers. And they live a long time and they can reproduce in open water environments. They do like to spawn normally in like river mouths and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But if there are spring gravel bars, they will reproduce on those.
Spring gravel bars.
So what that is, our lake has one in Michigan where it is a spring fed system, but there's actually floating gravel on top.
Huh.
So it mimics a river environment for reproduction.
That's kind of wild.
They're more common than you think because you really don't see them.
No, you never would unless you're...
If you, with a fish finder, a powerful fish finder, what you'll see is a fake bottom and then a hole.
Huh.
And that's the spring. But you can't like, they're pressurized.
Yeah.
You can't like fall into them.
No. Yeah. I get it. It's pushing water out.
Yeah. So it's not like it's a hole you're going to walk and fall into unless it's a really little spring.
Like there's no...
No flow, a couple gallons a minute kind of deal. You know, which is fine, but you're not going to like fall into, it's just water.
You're going to sink. Yeah. Oh, no.
Yeah. So that's one. I really think these could be lake trout. They really kind of sound like they're describing laker behavior. Another option are the esocs that can be mistaken for large trout species.
Now, is this when I said pike earlier?
Yep. The esocidae. So pike and muskellunge.
Yeah, which are so northern, pike on steroids.
Yeah.
That's what I call them.
They are. And both love eating salmonids.
Okay.
Both can be found in large glacial lake environments with deep water. Open water, generally musky preferred rather than pike. Pike can take that niche if musky aren't present. So I think there's a chance that there is a small... Musky never occur in high numbers.
Yeah, they're very...
They're apex, and they're very rare, and they're very secretive.
Yeah.
And... I think that some of these could be musky that were thrown into here. And the same kind of thing I described with the Lakers is that they forgot about him. They didn't see him for 3 or 4 decades. Or the guy that did it didn't come forward because it's illegal, probably, you know, importing an apex predator from North America.
Yeah, probably not good.
Because this lake was designed to be a commercial fishing destination.
And you throw a muskie in there.
Which is, like, there is benefits to that, you know, with the fish 10,000 casts, a place you can go. Like, the cool thing about these kind of things in Japan and China is that when you're fishing for apex predators, you can catch an apex predator from 5 different continents.
That's kind of,
in one pond.
And anyone that doesn't fish may not get that, but if you're just a common fisherman, that is just, what'd you say, every 10,000? 1 in 10,000 or something, which is still a cast, which is still wild, like to even have the potential.
They say it's the fish of 10,000 casts. Now, I have a couple on the walls, and you have a couple on the walls.
Musky?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I will say they're much, in my personal opinion, much easier to catch the higher up you go in Canada and such.
Probably, yeah.
Musky, why they're so hard to catch is they remember, like how their memory works in their brain is very unique to them.
Mm-hmm.
So if a muskie gets caught as a baby, it remembers the pain, because it hurts the mouth. They flash blood really hard. So it's it can be a really daunting process for them, especially as a baby. So they remember everything, but they don't know what caused it exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So they remember they bit a yellow fish, you know, the lure.
Yeah.
They bit a yellow lure on a sunny day in March. So now they'll never do that again.
Yeah.
So all those, they may not ever bite a yellow thing again on a sunny, and they may not bite anything on a sunny day, and they'll stop, you know, they're going all food off all March or all this water temperature.
You got to be pretty lucky or fortunate. So if they get caught
as a baby 3 or 4 times, the options of how to catch them as a big adult go way down.
Very limited.
Yeah. And they're known to follow, and I've watched them on cameras, you know, watch baits for 2 and 3 hours. Because they're just, you know, they're trying to figure out if it's a bait or not.
Yeah.
They're not dumb animals. I think there's a good chance that these mysterious giant trout could be musky. And they do have a similar body shape to some large salmonids. They're actually kind of closely related to salmonids.
Okay.
And if you've ever been around musky, you feel it because they're slimy and stinky. They smell like gizzard shad, if anybody's curious.
Mm.
Musky stink. I love musky, but they stink.
I don't know if we've never cut one open ever.
No, their outside stinks, not their inside.
Oh, okay. I've been hit with one.
They're slime. So it's slime, they produce a chemical
Blech.
Esox do this. They actually produce a chemical. So pike smell like fathead minnows. Mm-hmm. Fathead minnows actually produce a musk, almost like a mammal. And these little tiny fish the size of your fingers can stink when they're in breeding colors.
Mm, yummy.
The pike produces that same smell to mimic and get closer to prey animals.
So they don't know they're there.
Yeah. Pike or muskie do the same thing with gizzard shad. They produce a similar chemical in their skin. So gizzard shad stink in a way, and so muskies stink in a way.
Mm.
But it's a mask. So what a lot of times, a muskie will be right below a school of even stuff they may not be feeding on.
Yeah.
But they're waiting for that stuff to come feed on that school of bait fish that they want to eat.
Yeah. A wolf in sheep's clothing.
Yeah. But yeah, so I mean, that's kind of my options. The taimen, I think, is a really good option. A lot of people really, really think it's a taimen. I really think it's a laker. I think it's a lake trout. I think it's probably not as big because it can be really hard to judge fish's size.
Yeah.
So on Torch Lake, it's the second clearest lake in the U.S.
Okay.
You can watch lakers and king salmon swim down there like 80, 90 feet, and they look like they're people-sized.
Mm.
Because it's this weird magnifying effect with how clear the water is.
Yeah.
But you're watching fish swim below you like 80 to 100 feet.
That's crazy. I would like to see that.
I don't like Torch Lake freaks me out because of that. Like, you could... It has a lot of drownings because of that. Because
it's so clear?
Yeah. Bear Lake has a lot of drownings, and Lake Tahoe has a lot of drownings because of that. Because people swim deeper than you realize.
Why is it so clear? Is there a reason, or...?
Just pure water, filtration, no pollution. Like, it was very... It was always a more clear lake.
Yeah.
And now it's kind of this weird thing where it's comparable... Torch Lake and Tahoe are comparable to, like, what you see in, like, the Bahamas.
Oh, okay. Like, the clear sands and the... Or it's not sands, beaches and whatnot.
Yeah. They're both sandy.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah.
There was this... when I was in college, I had a professor, Ted Houghton. If you're listening to the show, Mr. Ted Houghton, you were a good teacher, which there's not a chance, but maybe. Who knows? But he was... I think I mentioned him before on the show. It was like me in the future, kind of.
Oh, yeah.
He was just kind of a... I don't know how to describe him. Just soft-spoken, but he would just go off on tangents, tell these stories sometimes, and he was telling a story about swimming in this lake in the mountains in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
Wish I could remember the name, but he said the water was just so clear, it was like swimming in air.
Oh, there's...
He was saying that it's because of the acid rain.
Yeah, it killed everything. So yeah. Here's my thing. It's not water at that point, technically. It's not pure water.
But it's safe enough to swim in.
Yeah, but it's not. It's a saline solution, essentially,
yeah,
at this point.
Which would be awesome. I would enjoy that.
That creek that burnt and ate my boots.
Oh.
Was with the high pH.
Yeah.
Was crystal clear.
Well, I bet.
It looked like glass.
Bleach.
No, it looked like glass moving.
Yeah.
Like, it was so weird to look at, because it's just high acidity water.
What's that called when when stuff's, like, flowing, like, you open a spout?
And laminar flow.
Laminar, yeah. Yeah.
It was almost like that, because, like, if there wasn't, like, stuff like shadows casting in it, there's parts where you couldn't see it. It was that clean.
That's awesome.
Well, no, because it's...
I mean, it's awesome
pure,
to see.
Pure sulfuric acid.
I mean, it's still awesome to see.
And killing Monday Creek for about 80 miles.
It's very awesome. I mean, in the terms of not awesome being, like, cool, but, like,
the
awesome.
Apocalypse.
Like, in awe.
Yeah, I still have, like, four more of these guys. So, yeah, it's definitely going to be a part two.
Okay. Yeah, I like these ones.
But I think a lot of them, some of them get more mysterious and odd and stuff like that. But I think these first two are definitely, because Japan has so many introduced species of fish, both publicly known and non-publicly known.
Yeah.
Like, there are wild bowfin populations in Japan. There are alligator gar in Japan because they're so... fish heavy as a society that either the food markets or the, like I talked about with the bowfin and alligator gar and such, the competitive nature of large predatory aquariums.
Mm-hmm.
So in Japan, a really cool thing, I know a little bit about both with like the Koi Foundation in Japan, because they're like Koi are $1 million, like $1 million a piece, $2 million, $4 million.
Mm-hmm.
So there's Koi ponds, but like, it's almost like the De Beers diamond market for koi.
Oh, gosh.
What I mean by that is, like, to buy some of these high-dollar koi,
you
have to earn the right to buy some of these high-dollar
koi. From this one pond, right?
Yeah.
Where they're breeding them.
Like that, there's, like, three or four companies. Like, there's one organization that keeps track.
Gotcha. Okay.
Of the genetic quality, essentially. Because there's, like, the emperor's koi stock from, like, 1,000 or 1,500 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So you can buy the offspring of that. So there's like breeders guides to that where they highly are regulatory of that. and to be certified as a koi breeder. It's never happened in the U.S. But people have tried. It's almost like you talk about with sumo, where people have tried to get them to verify a U.S. koi facility, and they just won't. They don't want to do it.
Ah, yes, I understand that. Very much their culture. Yeah. Because it's their stock, it's theirs, and they don't want to leave Japan, basically.
So, you know, there's a lot of sacredivity to it. So, mm-hmm. what a lot of businessmen start doing, because koi got so hard to, like, almost like, I've heard this with, like, Rolex and some of that kind of stuff, to buy, like, the high, like, you have to be a customer for so long to even be able to purchase some of the higher-end, rarer stuff.
Gotcha.
Some of these business people that are using these fish to kind of show off to the other high level people in the business world, that's too long.
Mm-hmm.
I need to be able to impress these people now. So they kind of moved into predatory fish from around the world.
Gotcha.
And then like platinum gar, which are designer alligator gar, like they've been bred so much in captivity. There is now like what's called a platinum version, which is like an all white, but blue eye. Like it's crazy looking.
Sounds cool.
And then a bowfin, there's what's called a ruddy bowfin, a spot tail bowfin, and black bowfin are very, very popular in their trades for American apexes. So it's just having these tanks of teeth, essentially.
Yeah.
And having like shovel nose catfish from South America and an American flathead and, you know, a taimen from Russia. And
yeah.
Just having these big tanks of teeth and electric eels and like all kinds of stuff.
It's a good status symbol.
Yeah, I mean, I'm right there with them. Like, I would, if I could afford it, yes, I'd have two walls of just fish. Teeth.
If you walked into someone's house and you seen that, you'd be like, oh, right.
This is my kind of people. I like this.
I respect him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I know one of the fish that the guy I worked for, he sold to, actually had in his office, in a building, had stepping stones over this pond in an office building.
Mm-hmm.
To get to his desk.
That's pretty sweet.
And that's where they were putting the giant predatory fish we were sending them.
That's pretty sweet. So he pushed people in there, that pond, right?
They weren't man-eaters.
Not piranha?
No, but it was like flathead catfish and bowfin and alligator gar and red-tail catfish.
When he chunked people up.
They would eat chunks of people, yeah.
He would throw the bodies in there.
There we go.
Business.
But yeah, that's where we're going to end this episode. Ooh. Hopefully you guys enjoyed this.
Here, wait. I got one little thing because it just kind of coincides. I was reading these, I have this book I've been reading. It's like the greatest fairy tales or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's really neat. It's really old too. But there was this one about this golden headed fish.
Okay.
And I don't know. It's just kind of neat because we're talking about fish and this reminded me of it, but I thought the story was cool. So basically there was it's a story of this king that was going blind. And, there was this traveler that came through and said, like, if someone catches a golden-headed fish and brings it back to me, I can make an ointment to restore the king's eyesight, but it has to be done within 100 days. And that's, like, basically the rules. So the king sent his son, the prince, and, like, men to go out and catch this fish and return it. So the son goes out, and he's fishing, never catches it, but on the 100th day, so the 100th day is up, and he finally catches the fish. But by the time he knows if he brings it back, it's going to be past 100 days, and it's going to be too late. The traveler will be gone, and then the doctors for the king are going to try to make the ointment anyways and kill the fish. So he decided just to release the fish because he didn't want to waste its life. So he was coming back and without the fish, and the king didn't believe him that he even tried. So he ordered his son's execution.
No, oh, jeez.
So his mom, the queen, basically gave him some gold and some, like, you know, peasant clothes, basically, and sent him off in the night.
To go hide
in another town, the new place, to hide from his dad, the king, because he's going to kill him or have him killed because he didn't bring the fish back. So...
What's the dad dying of?
He's not dying. He's just going blind.
Oh, blind. Sorry.
Yeah, he lost his eyesight. And did I say dying?
No.
Okay.
I'm not a great listener.
Okay, that's right. So yeah, he's going blind. So so now the king's gone blind, and now the prince. And then the mom told the prince, you know, when you go to another place or another town, do not accept any servants that want to be paid by the month. If any of them want to be paid monthly, do not do it. So. he went to the new town. He bought him a house and whatever, got all set up. And time after time, people kept approaching him, servants, like wanting to work for him, wanting to be a servant. And they all wanted to be paid monthly. And he said no, no, no to each and every single one of them. And then finally, an Arab came up to him and wanted to work for him as well. But he said, I'll do whatever you want me to do. But you only have to pay me at the end of the year one time and pay me whatever you think is I'm worth. So he finally accepted that one. So they were on this island, this town that they were on, and the prince went, and apparently whoever, there was this monster there, and whoever went to fight the monster would fall asleep or be dead, be killed. And the governor of the island said that he would offer half the land and his daughter, which she was like a really beautiful princess, to whoever
could kill this monster.
Could kill the monster, yeah. And let's see here what happened. And I think actually, no, that's not it. That's not it. I kind of jumped ahead. So the governor offered his daughter to this prince, to marry.
Where'd the Arab go?
The Arab's just his assistant, is the guy's assistant.
Okay.
Okay, so he comes back in. So he's this assistant that's doing all this stuff for him. And basically, he offers his daughter to this prince. But the problem is, every man that's married that daughter before dies or is dead or killed on their wedding day or the day they get married. So so he agrees to marry this beautiful daughter. And you know, everyone thinks that the guy allows it because he knows he's just going to die just like all the other ones. Mm-hmm. So as on the day of their wedding, he looks out his window and he sees like they're digging his grave out back already. And he's there with his wife.
It reminds me of Rango when the guy's measuring him for his sheriff's outfit and also measuring him for his casket.
Yeah, exactly. Same thing. And so basically the lady, the daughter, when he's... The guy's outside, the prince is outside looking at them, digging his grave, and she's standing behind him, and she opens her mouth, and this big, giant serpent comes out of her mouth. And so that's the monster that's been killing all of her husbands. It comes out of her mouth, and extends really long, and it's just getting ready to bite him in the back. Mm-hmm. And the Arab's there. He was hiding in the house, and he reached out and grabbed the snake and cut its head off. So when the guy came out the next morning, the governor was so impressed that the guy lived.
Like the first one.
The Arab didn't take credit for it. He gave the credit all to the prince, basically. And so the guy got, you know, all the money and the gold and they inherited with this princess. So now they're all set up. He's married. And he basically gives half the stuff that he was giving him to the Arab for helping him. Mm-hmm. And he gets a letter from his mom. His dad has died. The king has died. So he gets to go back home and reign over his territory now again. Now he's got these two places. So he's all excited to go back. And when he's ready to go, the Arab tells him he can't go with him. He's done. And he says, well, no, you did all this for me. All this is because of you. So I need you to come with me. And he says, no, I can't. Like, I'm done. Like, I'm getting called to come back, go back home. And he's like, well, why? Why don't you want to come with me? And he's like, because I am the golden-headed fish that you saved. So the Arab was the golden-headed fish the guy released and didn't mercilessly kill or needlessly kill to save his dad's eyesight because he knew it was too late. So it was the fish that turned into a human that served the prince and helped him get where he needed to be. And then when his time was done, he went back into the ocean.
I feel like this is a fever dream.
It's just like a cool little fairy tale. But I thought it was pretty neat.
We accidentally made this episode an hour long.
That's all right.
Maybe this will be a Monday episode instead.
It could be.
I thought it was going to be a Wednesday, but...
Could be.
Telling stories of fish.
The golden-headed fish. Look it up. I encourage anyone to read it. It's a nice little short story.
That was actually... So I have my fourth one here. It's literally called The Golden-Headed Fish.
Really?
Yeah, the dragonfish, aka the golden-headed fish.
Hmm. What, does it have special ointments to heal blindness?
Yeah, Ruel Gayo wanted to melt him down for curing something, it says.
Well, stay tuned.
I was joking.
I figured you were.
The dragonfish is on this list, but it's a dragon and a fish. Like Gyarados.
Is it red or blue?
Let's see.
No, that's the teaser. You don't let see. That's the teaser. They wait for next week.
All right. I have been the great and powerful mystery.
And I've been Jake Lynn 072. I think.
We'll catch you next week, guys.
Bye. Bye.
Hey, guys. Thank you for listening to Cribs of the Corn podcast. Remember, the best way to support the show is share it with a friend. But if you are craving more of the Jake clones
and more from Mr. E,
there's always extra content on Patreon
and our paid member space on cryptidsofthecorn.com.
We'll catch you next time with more exciting, fun, and informative information.
Bye! Bye.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.